Okay, so we're holding here. Perik, we're going to do a little bit less. I don't want to cut everybody out. You were right. Perik Shlishi, right here. You said it. Okay. So, like we said before, these chapters are just a description of the world. In the Rambam's understanding, there's an almost seamless connection between the physical, the quasi-spiritual, and the spiritual, and as it was understood once upon a time, that natural science, that science and philosophy are just they're the same, the same discipline. We'll skim through much of it just because I wanted to be thorough a little bit and go through everything. But okay, so the third chapter, he starts with the Galgalim. Now, let me explain what Galgalim are. This was the understanding that was extant at the time, and the world had the earth at the center, and there were nine circles around it. Now, I just need to explain a little bit about how people understood things. People were keen observers, and they had only their eyes, and they would sit down, they would look around at the world around them. And they would say to themselves, what do I see? So if you're sitting on an open field, you're going to see the following things up there. You're going to see seven or eight entities that keep moving in relationship to everything else. And then a trillion things that move as one unit. So the sun you'll see moving every day around and around. You'll see the moon moving. You will see things called planets. They're called planet means wanderers. And you will see through Saturn. Those are the planets you'll see. You'll see Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. Basically, those are things that you're going to see. You probably will not see anything more than that. And then you will see all the stars together as one unit. They never move in relation to each other. They just move in their position in the sky. So basically, you're having... it was envisioned as circles. It wasn't clear whether it's as if... Like, what's the correct picture? Are those circles like... slides, rails, where a monorail, where the planet or the sun moves on that piece around, or is it like a gem embedded in something, and when it moves, the whole thing moves around with it. So it's as if it would be frozen in a circle, and the circle itself is an entity that moves. That was the piece that was unclear. Didn't make all that much of a difference. There also was a need to explain. How the sun goes back without being seen. There might have been a need for an extra circle for that, but by and large, that was the picture that was seen, which is a perfectly valid way of looking at it. It's not. We need to understand that. As long as our calculations work, whatever picture we have is correct. It really doesn't make a difference. The Rambam is not taking this from the Gemara. He's not claiming. He says at the end of one of his other chapters that he took this from Greek, from the Greek astronomy, and it's fine. It doesn't. It's not. None of it is really relevant theologically all that much. So he goes through. He says there are these nine circles. He says we have the closest one is the lunar one. And then we have Mercury, we have Venus, we have the Sun, we have Mars, we have Jupiter, we have Saturn, we have the stars, and then we have another circle that circles back in the other direction. It closes everything else. And then he goes on to explain. He says each one of these, each circle has many layers of circles. He says these circles have neither weight nor real colors. And the colors that always, the colors that we see are simply optical mirages. In other words, it's just the, sort of the way it refracts us the light, mm-hmm. but the blue is not, which is very, very accurate, actually. They also don't have any taste or smell. Basically, the point that the Rambam does say is that these entities don't have any physical properties. And it was the significance of it to Rambam was that there's always going to be a midpoint between two levels. It's something of existence, and something that if we can think a minute is true to us as well. For instance, between the vegetable kingdom and the animal kingdom, we might have something like bacteria that are neither here nor there, and we can't really get we can't fit it snug in one or the other. Between the inanimate and the animate, we have viruses, which are somewhat living and somewhat not living. Between man and animal, we have monkeys, which are somewhat human-like and somewhat not. There seems to be, it almost seems to be a pattern in the Bria that we have a hard time making exactly defined segments, because there's always sort of a midpoint, and in a different way of looking at it, that's very significant. We have that in Torah. We have the written law, that's the Torah. But in the Torah itself, the fifth part, which is Devarim, is the midpoint between. It's Moshe Rabbeinu saying over what Hashem told him. So it's what Hashem told him, but it's already Moshe repeating it. So that's the beginning of the next phase of Torah. Between Ksuvim and between the Nach and Torah Sheba'al Peh, we have Megillas Esther, which Chachamim said they didn't want to put it in. It didn't belong in Tanakh, but it was pushed into Tanakh. So that was kind of something that should have been oral, but it was written. So that's the midpoint between Gemara, so to speak, and Mishnah, and the Ksuvim. We then have something like the Gemara says between the Tanoim and the Moroim. The Gemara picks out the Rav as being a Tano Pali. Even though Rav was technically an Amora, he was able to argue with a Tana. We have in the Ashek Nesak Dola, the last one of Ashek Nesak Dola is the first person to appear in the Mishnah. Shimon Asher HaTzadik was the first person that we have, chronologically, that we have some record of his in the Mishnah. So it was always kind of, there's a continuum, and the continuum is expressed by having midpoints. Mm-hmm. So the heavenly bodies to us sitting here, they're visible, so that already makes it physical, but in our eyes, all it is fire. It's something that no other sense relates to it, and it's all fire in motion, light in motion. So that, to us, is sort of, we have a picture of something which is quasi-physical, quasi-spiritual. And that's why it's significant, not only as an astronomical description, it's significant in what its place is in the world. Okay, four. He says all of these spheres are round. The Earth is in the middle. This was, even though the idea that the Earth is in the middle and the Sun is around it, the model of making the world the center of the world, the Earth the center of the world, is something which is today we don't look at it that way anymore, but it never really had roots in Judaism. It's interesting. There is no place that discusses that. There are verses that speak about the sun going around the earth, but I have a counter to that. It says also about the sun, the sun is like a groom marching out of the chuppah. I don't think anyone imagines that to mean that the sun is dressed in a kittel and he's being danced in. It's a metaphor. it is certainly appropriate that the metaphor of the sun to us is sun that rides in the morning and sets. It's only very late, and when you know when the Copernican way of understanding the motion of the planets started becoming popular, most rabbis were fine with it. There were one or two who felt it's wrong, but I don't think it has. One would be very, very hard put to find clear proof to the contrary that the Torah has any position. The Catholic Church had a very vehement position, but I don't think we have to stand up for them. They you know, let them take care of themselves. There was no. In the Rambam paints the picture the way he understood it, the way it was understood then. That's fine. He says some of the stars have their own little spheres. That they rotate around, and part of it is, I guess it's obvious to anyone who's done all science, no one can see what goes around what. It doesn't go fast enough. But if we stand and map out the different sightings of the planets and the stars that we see, if the Earth were the center, it requires a tremendously agonizingly complex circles and mini circles, especially if you're assuming that motion is only circular, then it requires a staggering amount of complexity to draw the picture. If the sun is the center, and we're one of the things going around the sun, a simple circle or parabola would do it for us, and it obviously makes more sense to go with the simpler. But so that's why the Rambam says each some of these stars have their own small inner circles and sub-circles, because that was needed to give that. The Rambam then lists how many there are, and he says all of this, the Rambam says, is part of astronomy, and he says Bisfarim Rabim Chibur Chochma Yavan, and many of the Greek scholars have made runners worth of those works. Aristotle was considered to be the scientist, and this is coming from there. That's what he's saying. It's not coming from anyplace else, which is fine as long as it stands proven. It's perfectly right and perfectly legitimate from Torah point of view. Then he says there is the ninth, which circles everything around, and that is split into 12 parts. Let's understand a little bit about this, because this is helpful to understanding the many different chazal and so on. What is the zodiac and what are the mazalos that we speak about? So let's understand it as follows. Stars can, if you look at the stars, you can see them as clumps of stars. There are groupings in places that have more stars, and some of the prominent ones have a they seem to suggest a figure of sorts. Now, being that the sun and the stars, what happens is, being that we're circling the sun, we see a different segment of stars at a different part of the day each period of time. In other words, imagine let's say somebody's spinning you around a room, you're going to see different parts of the room. And if you, imagine yourself, somebody is carrying you on his shoulders around the building, so you see different parts each time. Imagine also that you are making a circle around the person. So you're on his shoulders, but you keep spinning around. So the difference is, you'll always, so with every circle that you make, you'll see the entire building, but it'll be at different segments of your circle. So the part of the sky we see at 9 o'clock in the morning, or the part of the sky we would see at 9 o'clock in the morning in September is very different than the one in April, and very different than the one in June. We see the same layout of stars, but depending on the time of the year, the stars that serve as the backdrop for when the sun rises is going to be different. The astrologists saw in this a tremendous sign of sorts as to what the Mazel is. Because they felt that the stars influenced the world greatly. The Rambam does not hold like that, but this was astrology. They felt that the sun rising through a certain clump of stars infuses with some power, and that's the dominant mazel. So in other words, whatever it is that forms the mazel is the significant, that's the type of time it is. That's the type of, and that's where you have this mazalos. So the Rambams needed a backdrop. In other words, everything is against the backdrop, and that's the ninth, and that's that ninth sphere. He then says, he says that those spheres, that when we speak about these stars being one in the spring and one in the summer and one in the winter, he said it's not constant anymore, which is correct. And because there is a difference between the year of the sun and the year of the stars, he says they were true at the time of the Mabul, they're not true today anymore, they've moved. So what Chazal spoke about is being true by Yetzias Mitzrayim, that it was Mazel Flair, it no longer is accurate. That's what Ram says, and that's quite right. So whatever we speak about these Mazalos, they were true specifically at the point of origin. But today, that's not true anymore. Okay, 8. He says, all the stars that we see, some of them are as small than the Earth. Some of them are much larger than the Earth. And now he gives a number. He says the Earth is bigger than the Moon 4 times. The Sun is bigger than the Earth 170 times. And, you know, thereby just the reckoning, the moon is 1/6,800 of the sun. And he says there's no star bigger than the sun, and nothing smaller than one of the stars on the second, than Mercury, I guess. My assumption is it's taken from Aristotle, and I don't know how he proved it, but whatever it is, that was their understanding. Okay, 9. This is already a theological point, and it's a point that the Rambam holds like that. Some disagree, many disagree, but it's up there. The Rambam says all of these stars have a certain level of soul and understanding. They are alive, and they're aware of the Creator. Each one, depending on his stature, and they praise God like the angels. So whenever we find many times in Psalms praises that the stars and the planets give to God, you could learn it as passive entities. In other words, looking around at the awesome planets, it's a tremendous praise for God. Or the Rambam learned it that quite literally, that they themselves were living entities and praised God. From a theological point of view, it's a great argument between the various Rishonim. I believe many of them do not hold like the Rambam, but that's Rambam's position, that all those Pesukim are quite literal. And he says, and just like they recognize God, they can recognize themselves. In other words, there's consciousness, self-awareness, and they understand the angels which are above them. He says the celestial beings are one above man, one under the angels. Mm-hmm. It's hard. We're not going to. You know, we're looking for life in the outer space. That outer space itself has life. That's something that we'll never really know. But that's Ramos' point. The Rambam elaborates on this in Mor Nevuchim. It's really, really, either way you go with it, it's not an essential point, not an essential theological point, but it is his point. And then he says that then he goes down and he says, between the moon and the earth, there is another entity, And basically, let's explain what he refers to over here. The ancients understood that there are four elements that the world consists of, which was a very reasonable position if the only instrument you had was your eyes. So if I can categorize everything in the world into classes of things, I wouldn't choose colors, doesn't seem so important, and it changes, but I would say solid, liquid, gas, energy. That's how the Greeks saw the world, and everything is a combination of these various things. So the Rambam says, so this obviously exists, in other words, it's as if the elementary particles of the world are these four elements, and then the world itself is a very complex composition of these particles. So the Rambam says they exist here as a combination of all of these particles. So there's a stage, so to speak, where all of these things are still in their pure state. They're just elements, and they don't have yet their specific state. He says, so each one of these, there's the world of water, the world of wind, which is gas, the world of earth, and the world of fire, which is energy.
Mm.
He says these four elements do not have any knowledge, awareness, they're inanimate. And each one has natural laws which it does not perceive, doesn't understand, does not really, has no consciousness, no self-awareness. It literally is inanimate, and that's it. Okay, I think we'll hold it here. It's the end of chapter 3. So basically, we've sketched out the important points.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 4, he will also continue sketching it down to the world, to the earth. He's going to recap some points that are important that he said before. And then we will skip 5 and 6, which deal with halakhas actually, and come back to 7, which goes back to prophecy and so on. Okay?
Does he go into any detail about what do you mean, like the stars having awareness and awareness of the creator?
Not much more. A little bit more in the next chapter,
uh-huh,
he's going to say about it. But there's not much more we can say about it, except that it's there. I know there's no sense. He puts their awareness, their consciousness, as being above man's, in other words, being much more. Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. And to him, it was necessary because you need to have that continuum. Man to angel is a very big jump, and something in the middle that bridges that gap, which is quasi-physical, quasi-spiritual, is what he wanted to put in. Mm. Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Where are you from?
In Washington.
Good.
I stay in put.